Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we're going to finish up Rashi's approach to the story of the Akedah, to the binding of Isaac, Yitzchak. Just a few little Rashi's we left off with at the end, and then we'll start with Rav Hirsch momentarily. The last thing that we had done, just as a review, was in verse 14, in which Abraham names the place after the entire episode takes place, and he slaughters the ram instead of his son Isaac. He names the place Hashem Yireh, that Hashem will see, literally. Asher Yeyamer Hayom, because as it is said, this day, that on the mountain, Hashem will be seen. So he names the place that it will be on this place, on this mountain, that eventually it's destined that Hashem will be seen. And we had seen that Rashi had quoted, the last thing we did was the Medrash on the top of page 238. Meaning the top, on the top of the Rashi elucidated section on page 238, towards the back of your sheets. An Agadic Midrash interprets that verse, meaning Hashem Yireh, that Hashem will see this binding to forgive Israel because of it every year and to save them from punishment. That this binding is going to stand in our stead. This will be in our corner to spare us from punishment. So that it will be said on this day in all future generations, that on the mountain of God there will be seen the ashes of Isaac still piled up as if he had actually been sacrificed for atonement on behalf of Israel. So a very interesting concept. This is what we last I saw. Hashem Yireh, that Hashem will see, as if the Medrash sees it, that Hashem will see, it's as if the ashes of Isaac are still there, serving as an atonement on behalf of the Jewish people, as if he had actually been sacrificed. Now, we don't believe in human sacrifice. We don't believe in human sacrifice to atone for others. That's sort of been taken by another religion that we are familiar with. But the Medrash sees that the fact that Abraham went through this and was willing to sacrifice his son is in itself, will serve as a potential atonement year after year after year, which we recall every year on Rosh Hashanah particularly, when we blow the shofar, the ram's horn, and it recalls the incident of the binding of Isaac, that ash should be seen as if he was sacrificed as an atonement for the Jewish people. This is an interesting thread that these sages see in this episode for that concept of an atonement for us. Okay, let's just pick up and finish up the story. Verse 16, Vayomer, so now, 15, the angel of Hashem called to Abraham a second time from heaven. So now we have a second calling of the angel to Abraham, and he said, B'nishpati ne'um Hashem, by myself I swear the word of Hashem, that because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only one. Again, we had that phrase of not withholding your son as seeming to be the thread, the theme of Abram's not keeping his son back. And again, that double language of your son, your only son. What happens because of that, says the angel to Abram, Ki varech avarechecha, double language, I shall surely bless. Barech avarechecha, I will bless, I will bless. Which is often translated as, I will surely, I will definitely, I will do this. The harbo arbe es zaracha, and I will greatly increase. Again, a double language. Barech avarechacha, I will surely bless. Harbo arbe, I will certainly greatly increase your offspring like the stars of the heaven and the sand al sfas hayom on the seashore. And your offspring shall inherit the gate of its enemy. And we saw already in the Ramban, the Ramban's comment was that last phrase is really what's being added here. The blessing of being numerous like the stars and being numerous like the sand had been mentioned to Abram already. And here it was a blessing that they will inherit the enemy's gate, to say that blessing will never cease. You will always have the blessing of being as numerous as the stars and of the sand, and you will be able to inherit the gates of your enemy. That because now what's been added with this episode is that Abram is now blessed and promise that he will always prosper, and that his enemies will not at any point ever be able to destroy him. Rashi has two simple comments on this double language, Barech Avarech on 17 and down below if you'll look, I shall surely bless you. which again literally is bless, I shall bless. One expression is for the Father and one is for the Son. Rashi here comments that why is the double language used here? Because they both were active participants in this, Avram and Yitzchak going through with this, and therefore they both receive, so to speak, their own blessing. And similarly, in the next phrase of I shall surely increase your offspring, again, one expression is said for the Father and one for the Son. 18, v'hisbaruchu v'zarecho kol goyei ha'aretz, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your offspring, meaning they will say, you shall be as blessed as the offspring of Avraham and his children, we will become the standard bearers for blessings in the world. Ekev asher shomata b'koli, because, why? You have listened to my voice. And again, you have that, we're always looking for clues as we're going through what was this test about, and here what Hashem gives the reason through the angel at the end, and what was it that the nations of the world will bless their children through you? Because you heeded my voice, you listened to that which I asked of you. And then the story concludes with Avraham returning to his young men. Vayakumu vayelchu yachtov el Beersheva, they got up, they went together to Beersheva, and Avraham dwelled in Beersheva. Now we noted here, and Rashi does not comment on this, but we noted here, I'm just going to keep on bringing up the same points until we get through the whole story and we try to piece everything together. There were a number of verbs which were interesting to us here at this point in the story. Number one is, who's returning to the lads?
Avraham.
It's only Avraham. So we noted that in the beginning of the story, all the verbs were singular. Everything was about Avraham. But then when they left the donkey behind with the two lads, there, for the first time, we saw plural verbs. Avraham and Yitzchak. And what was the verb that we saw them doing?
They went together.
Vayelchu shnehem yachtav. They went together. We saw that phrase twice. We saw them traveling together right after they left the donkey. And then after Yitzchak says to his father, I see the knife, I see the fire. Where is the kid? Where is the goat? Where is the sacrifice? And Avraham says, Hashem will choose it for himself, my son. Then the Torah repeated, and they went alone. They traveled together. Now, at the end of the story, we have a very funny reversal in this, because the verbiage returns to the singular, and Avraham returned seemingly alone to his lads. And then what does Avraham do with the lads?
They go together.
The same phrase, Vayelchu Yachtov. They travel together back to Beersheba. So we take the same phrase that we said about Avram and his son Yitzchak as them traveling together, both before Yitzchak knows and after Yitzchak knows. And now we have Avram returning alone, singular verb, and now we borrow that same phrase and they travel together, but now it's not referring to Avram and Yitzchak, it's now referring to Avraham and his two lads. Very, very interesting. We also have an extra verb in this verse. Where's the extra verb here?
Stood up and went.
Right, they stood up. What does that add? I mean, Avraham returns to his young men, and they stood up. Why? Just tell me what they did. They went back. They returned back to Beersheba. Now, this same word, they stood up, appeared elsewhere in the story. If you remember, we were bothered by it.
Yeah,
if you go all the way back to verse 3,
when Avraham was preparing,
excellent, right? When in verse 3, if you flip back to the beginning of your packet, Avraham arose early in the morning. Verse 3, in other words, verse 1 was God calling out to Avraham with the test. Verse 2 was what the test is, and then verse 3 is Avraham preparing to set out on his journey. In verse 3, I think we had 6 verbs in verse 3. Avraham arose early in the morning. He saddled his donkey number 2. He took his two lads with him.
He chopped the wood
for the offering, and he stood up and went to the place of which God had spoken to him.
Yeah.
And we had all, like, what do you mean? He stood up. What was that, number 4 or number 5 in the list? He's been running around all morning. He's gotten up early. He's got everything ready. Saddled the donkey. He's chopped the wood. He took his lads, and then it says, and he stood up and went to the place of which God had spoken. Well, when you talk about the way that what's it called, the chiasm? I forget if there's a word. Rabbi Buckman actually referenced it last night. Where you don't go A, B, C, C, B, A. When you're reading a story. So we started with A in the beginning of the story. We had this extra word, vayakumu. You go through this whole story. And at the very end of the story, you end up back in that same verb. that we couldn't figure out what it was doing in the beginning, and now appears again here at the end, that at the end of the story, Abraham returns to his lads, and they get up and return together, same phrase that we had of Abraham traveling with his son Yitzchak, to Be'er Sheva, and Abraham dwelled in Be'er Sheva. Now, Rashi points out here in the bottom of 238, Rashi says, and Avram dwelled in Be'er Sheva, not actual dwelling, right? Not really true. He didn't actually live in Be'er Sheva, for he was dwelling in Hebron. 12 years before the binding of Yitzchak, he left Be'er Sheva and went to Hebron. So why then he returned to Be'er Sheva, that he actually was living in Hebron at the time. As it says, and Avram sojourned in the land of the Philistines many days, and many implies, flipping to the back half of your back page of your packet, more than the first ones in Hebron, more than the days he had previously lived in Hebron, meaning he dwelled now. And the days he lived in Be'er Sheva were 26, as we explained before. So what was he doing here in Be'er Sheva? So the commentators explained that he was there to present offerings in the place of Be'er Sheva at his Eisha. That was the place where he had originally set up his tents, his camp, and he went back to that place to offer, to present offerings. Now, we're going to try to get back to this also. If Rashi is saying he really lived in Hebron, why does the Torah make such a big deal about dwelling in Be'er Sheva? And he went to Be'er Sheva, he dwelled, it sounds like he lived in Be'er Sheva. We're going to have to get back to that. What it exactly is the Torah wants us to know, why it's so significant exactly where he went afterwards. Let's do one more verse. In other words, what's going to happen here at the end is the Torah is going to have a series of verses, which I didn't even bring all of them over here, which is going to list the birth of Rivka. So if you flip on the top of page 239, we'll just read it in English quickly, and it happened after these matters, after Acharei HaDvarim HaEilu, which was the same phrase that started this episode. And so you have two sides of your packet, right? On the beginning of chapter 22, where the opening phrase is, Vayihi Achar HaDvarim HaEilu, and it was after
these words,
which we interpreted as words more than things, based on Rashi, who understood that there must have been some words involved. And now the end of the story, Vayihi Acharei HaDvarim HaEilu, and it was again after these matters, and it was told to Avram, saying, behold, Milchah Shitu has borne children to Nachor, your brother, and we go through the list of Uz and Buz, Kemuel and Aram, Aviarab and Kesed and Chazon and Pilevish and Yilav and Besuah Yoledes Rivka Shmona Eila Yolda Milka LeNachar. These eight, which concludes with Rivka, were born to your brother Nachor. Rashi comments on in verse 20, after these matters that Avram was told, saying, meaning upon his return from Mount Moriah, Avraham was pondering and saying, had my son already been slaughtered, I would be going without children. I should have married him off to a woman from among the daughters of Aner, from Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre, who were the three. Avram had a group of three people who were his advisors, who he had befriended from some previous stories. I should have married off my son to one of their daughters, and therefore Hashem informs him not to worry. Rebekah, who was going to be Yitzchak's wife, has already been born to your own family. And that's what it means after these matters. After which matters? The pondering of matters which came about because of the binding of Isaac. Meaning Rashi here is again picking up on Achar HaDvarim, what things took place, what matters? That Avram was wondering after this whole episode in which he almost had his son killed, maybe it's time to get him married, maybe it's time to have him start his own family and now actually continue this lineage and the promise which has been given to him that he'll be the father of a great nation. And so the story of the binding of Isaac ends with the birth of Rebecca, and then the very next parsha, this parsha has one or two more verses in it, and then the very next parsha is the death of Sarah, and then Abraham sending out his servant Eliezer to actually find the wife that will be for Yitzhak. Which again, just to note the parallel, when we go back to the story of Yishmael, that story also ended after Avram was told to send out his son, his only son from that mother, which he does. Child almost dies, is miraculously saved. An angel has an entire conversation with Hagar, just like we have over here, in which Avram sends out his son. Son almost dies, he has an entire conversation with an angel. And then both stories end with the principal character in the story finding a wife and going back to their homeland to do so. Hagar goes back to her homeland of Egypt, Mitzrayim, to find a wife for her son,
Yishmael, and Avraham goes back to his family in his birthplace to find a wife for his son, Yitzchak. So there's a certain parallel that we find, and we point out a number of times as we go through in the story. So far, so good? Okay, that's Rashi.
Did you ever say who the two men were that went
so with So the Torah does not identify them. Rashi did. Rashi identified them based on the sages as Yishmael and Eliezer, the servant of Avraham and Avraham's other son.
Which now,
right, which was very different. Another because if, for a couple of reasons, which we pointed out, we'll hopefully get back to. So a lot of things we'll get back to. Number one, Yitzchak is 37 years old at the time, so the episode of Yishmael was sent out soon after his birth, when Yitzchak was just weaned. He was 2, he was 3, he was somewhat in that early age of development, and Yishmael is sent out. So it's 30 years easy post the expulsion of Yishmael, so that the sages see that one of the lads is in fact this person of Yishmael, who's now in his 50s, would indicate that either he did the tshuv at the end of his life and he returned and he dwelled again in the house of Avraham, even though he'd been expelled and he had now come back, or something else. But that's going to be in it, that the sages see that this lad is being Yishmael, when it's not like a hidden story, it's like it's right there in the Chumash, and he was expelled from the house of Avraham just a chapter or two before. Now, even though it's just a chapter or two before, but it's 30 years have gone by, but something has clearly happened over those 30 years that the sages see that this is in fact the person of Yishmael who has returned. But that's something we'll have to try to address, Mr. Hashem.
Hmm. Eliezer's even worse.
Why?
Because he, Avraham called him an old man at the time that God was promising that he would have children. He's just got nobody in his home except.
So he was, right. You wouldn't consider him a lad then. That's
how you're saying because he's called a lad. That's what you're saying. So that was troubling that, I wasn't even thinking, all right. In other words, they're called lads, so Yishmael, who's now being called a lad, you know, a Na'arav, is in his 50s. You know, 14 years older than Yitzchak, even. And Eliezer is also an older... So it is interesting. It is an interesting point. But the Torah does not identify them. The Torah itself just calls them the two lads of Avraham, and they're not identified. Okay. Let's take a look at Refersh, as always. Beautiful commentary. And we will spend a few days in this. There's not going to be class next week. Let me just mention that now before I forget. I am going to be going to APAC in Washington, D.C.
Oh, wow.
And I will be returning on Tuesday, and between my schedule getting back and permanent events, I just think I don't want to.
President Obama is speaking too.
Yeah, that should be interesting.
Yeah. What? No, someone said Netanyahu who was speaking, and I said President Obama is also supposed to be speaking.
Okay. So Shamshon Rafal Hirsch, the great German leader, late 1800s. As we have mentioned, so his commentary was written again in German. It has been translated. They actually just came out with a newer translation, but I'm still going with the old one here. They just redid it and retypeset it recently. Okay. You know, so what we do though, as we go through this experience, and then we did Rashi, the Ramban, and now first we're going through the story. Let's like go back to the beginning of the story. And here we go, back to the beginning, each time picking up new pearls of wisdom as we go through. Okay, Achar HaDvarim HaEilah, and it came to pass after these things that God tested Avram and said to him, Avram, and he said, here I am. Verse that we are familiar with already. You'll note right away in his translation, how does he translate Achar HaDvarim HaEilah after these
things,
which is the more literal translation. Rashi's, the art scroll Sefer on Rashi, being that Rashi translates it based on the sages that it's to be taken word, they put it into their translation that it means after these words, but the literal translation would certainly be after these things. And I always like to just point out that's part of the depth of the Torah, the way that the Torah is constructed, that the biblical Hebrew is open to many, many, many layers of meanings and interpretations, and all of which are accurate and true. And when you write an English translation, you have to pick and choose, and you're forced, when you put it into English, you lose all of that nuance of the language by putting it into another language. Okay, says Refersh, Achar HaDvarim, it was after these things, similarly to above other times that we find this introduction of a paragraph, and Refer says these words introduce a crisis, a reversal of all that went before. When you say it was after these things, Refer says, look throughout Tanakh, it's going to refer to some form of a reversal and introduction to a crisis. What's the crisis here that this is going to introduce? So this is pretty obvious in our situation over here. Abram had already proclaimed God as the Elokei Olam, the God of the world. That's his mission in life. He's been screaming it from the hilltops. Isaac had been born, and after generations, decades of childlessness, now he has himself a son who's going to continue that mission. The elder son had been sent away for his sake. We've already experienced that we have to send Yishmael out because we have to protect this new child who's going to be the bearer of the Abrahamic dynasty. Be Yitzchak, because in Yitzchak the seed of the future is to be carried on, and this future had already been recognized in the present, meaning that we know this is the child who's going to become all that's destined to be. The king of the land had already concluded a treaty embracing not only Isaac himself, but with his further descendants, and that was the brief paragraph in between the expulsion of Yishmael and our story, which you read, and we glanced over it, where Avimelech, the king of the Plishtim, came and made a peace treaty with Avram. So Refersh is bringing that into painting the picture of, look at what has already been set up. We know where the future lies. The groundwork of the background has been set with the kings of the land. So that Isaac's promised future had already struck roots in the contemporary presence. And now comes the behest to break up all that has happened hitherto. It's all over. When you say, like, and again, we've mentioned, like, what was the test? The Torah tells us God tested Avram. What was it? Just to listen to my voice? Was it loyalty? Was it fear? Was it love? What is it there? So our first paints a picture of, well, we can't ignore the fact that what it is destroying and reversing everything that had been set up until this point. We're going to destroy all of that groundwork that's been laid because I said so. Ho Elokim, the God. Now we mentioned again as we went through that the name of God used in this story all the way through is Elokim, 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 the God of judgment. Until when? Until the angel stops Avraham from carrying it out. That's the first time that we see the angel of Hashem. Otherwise, it's always Elokim. Says refers to Elokim, the God, the same God who had revealed himself to Avraham and had made Isaac the combination of the whole aim of Avraham's life. That God who came to Avraham and appointed Yitzchak as the future of this mission, Nisa, tested. Now, as we see many times from Refersh, Refersh is a tremendous linguist, so he takes the words and their root and shows how you can understand the meaning of each word based on its similar root words that it shares. So Nisa, which means to test, Nun Samachay, is related to Nasa, with an ayin at the end. Anyone know Seya means to travel, or moving on, or Nasach, which means to fling away, or Nasa, which means to raise up. So these four words are all very similar. Nisa, to test. Nasa, to travel. Nasach, to fling away. Or Naso, to raise up. All three having the concept of bringing something to a further or higher position. I travel. I take something from one place to another place. We saw this when first commented on the Tower of Babel. When they built the tower, they traveled away from the east. They wanted to distance themselves and bring themselves to a new place. Fling away, move it away from you, raise something up. All of them connote taking something from the place that it is now and moving it somewhere else. So in the same way that Nasa or Nisa to test regarding physical or moral forces. So just like the root of this word always means moving something, a test always has that meaning of moving someone or moving something. Meaning to test, i.e. to give it such tasks to do which up till now it has not proved its ability to accomplish. Hence, every test is a step forward, is a strengthening of powers which exist already but which have not yet been proved in this further or higher task. Right, we saw a very similar idea in in the Ramban, in Nachmanides, that every idea of a test is to bring out the latent potential which exists in the person and actualize it, make it real, bring it out into the world. So Rav Hirsch says, it's in the word Nisa, just like a Noseya is a traveling, taking a physical person from this place to that place. Nisa, a test, is a spiritual traveling. It's taking the who you are, not physically from point A to point B, but emotionally, morally, spiritually, from this place that you are. Well, how do I do that? If I travel, I pick you up, I move you. Well, how do I get you to spiritually move from one place to another? That's the concept of a test. And that's really the brilliance of the Jewish perspective of when we deal with these difficulties in life, which we all have. It's a test. Life is a test because God is trying to move us from point A, where we start, to point B, where we need to end. And we morally, emotionally, spiritually are moved, not by getting in a car and driving somewhere, but by the test that we face and the fortitude that we have to gather to pass. And that's why the root of those words are so similar. Nasa, to travel. Naso, to raise up. And Nisa, to test, because they share that concept. Okay, rope, which has already stood the strain of 50 pounds, is put to the test as soon as it is given 51 pounds to bear. But moral and spiritual forces are thereby strengthened and raised. And the rope doesn't become stronger when you put 51 pounds on it. We're just testing how much strength is in it. The human, the moral, spiritual forces, so to speak, become stronger. Each test that we endure, we actually become, we actualize that which we could have been, and now we become stronger people. Like a muscle actually becomes stronger. In other words, a rope doesn't become stronger when you raise it 51 pounds. We're just testing how much it can hold until it snaps. A muscle that's raised 50 and now raises 51 actually becomes stronger. So too, in our spiritual tests, the spiritual core of our being actually becomes stronger as we endure each one of those tests, and we only know that we're growing in the same way, and this is not my example, this is used often, in the same way that somebody who wants to build endurance or strength in their physical body knows, no pain, no gain. That's not just a cute phrase, that's the reality. Without the pain of resistance, your muscles will not get stronger. They must go against that force. If 50 pounds I can do, 51 is tough. In the strain comes the muscle building activity, and life is the same way. It's without the pain of the spiritual strength that we need to grow and endure, through the endurance of the difficulties that we have, grows and comes the spiritual strength as well. Okay, let's go to verse 2. Vayomer. So Hashem tests Avram, and he says to him, Avram, and Avram responded with, Hineni, here I am. Now the test was, Kach nas bincha, take your son. Your only one, whom you love, Yitzchak, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him up there as an offering on one of the mountains which I will tell you. That's the verse, right? Familiar with that? I would not have worked off of this English translation. This is like, you know, that old biblical English translation. Okay, let's read our verse's commentary on this. No. Now, we mentioned that Rashi pointed this as well, that Hashem uses this very interestingly. He says, please take your son. So Rashi had a bunch of comments in terms of, to be able to allow me to answer to the nations of the world or to the Satan who are going to say, what's with this Avraham? Why are you giving him and his descendants so much special treatment and showing them so much love? Please pass this test so I'll be able to say, that's why. Look at what Avraham was willing to do. That's what Rashi commented on the language of na. Says Rav Hirsch, no, please take, do take. I know full well what I am asking of you. I know how your whole inner self must struggle against it. Rav Hirsch comes from a different angle. Not that Hashem is asking Avraham to be able to now come to the nations of the world or to the Satan with a claim. He's saying, no, please, meaning I get it. I get that I'm not asking something small. I get that I'm not asking. I know what I'm asking. I know that you're going to have to deal with every fiber of your being to struggle with this particular test because it goes against everything. It's the reversal of Achar Advarim Ha'il, everything that you've lived your life for until this point. I'm asking you to throw it all away. and therefore I recognize that in my request, please take of your son, and I know of your whole inner self and struggle with this. Es bincha, it is your son I am demanding, your only one, the one to whom your whole soul clings. It is Yitzchak, to whom the whole meaning of your life is attached, in his poetic phrase. This, I know the connection that you have with Yitzchak, the son that you've davened for, prayed for, cried over for decades. And that's the son that I am asking for. Now, this is the son described as Asher Ahavta, the son that you love. Says Rav Hirsch, Ahav, or Hav, from the word to give, with the prefix Aleph, meaning the root of the word love is to give. And this is one of the most fundamental principles in Judaism. Rav Eliyahu Dessler, who lived in the early 1900s in Europe and then later in Israel, was made famous with one of his essays that became very popular, that the idea, what he asks it as a question, do you give to the people that you love, or do you love the people to whom you give? That was the question that he posed. Which one comes first? Do you give gifts to the people you love, or do you love the people to whom you give gifts? Now, gifts doesn't mean literally, presents means anything of yours, your time, your resources. So he has a long essay describing that in Jewish thought, human nature, we believe is that we love those that we give to. That's the starting point. And it's a very, very natural thing. It starts with a parent, you know, a mother carrying her child for 9 months, then going through the labor and the delivery, and then all the sleepless nights as the parents begin. You give so much to the child, so you love that child. As you give, you love more. In our relationships, when we give, when we are involved in something, we connect through the giving of ourself to the person to whom we're given. And that's where the relationship comes from. Not that we love comes from somewhere else and then we want to give love. A love that came from somewhere, where did it come from? What else happened that created that love that I would then want to give gifts to? If it's not built on the relationship, the giving, so then it's going to be built on something else which won't stand. It won't last the test of time. And therefore, and he proves, as Rav Hirsch is starting from, the word love in Hebrew comes from have, to give. The root of the word to love comes from to give, because it's to whom you give that you will love. And if you want to, or Besser concludes the whole essay, if you have somebody that you're not close with and you want to become close, you feel like there's just something, we're just not getting along, give to that person. Find opportunities to give, whether or not it be physical gifts or resources, time, energy, something. When you give to someone, that's what develops the relationship. Anyway, I don't spend too much time on that. That's where he's going to be coming off of here. So, Asher Ahavta, this is the son to whom you love. You love this son. So give, have, with the prefix of Aleph, hence, equally giving oneself up. What does it mean to love? It means giving yourself up, devoting oneself to the other, and seeking to bring the other as near as possible to oneself. True love, a relationship of two people who love each other, where they're both trying to give, not saying, what do I get out of that? That's not a relationship of love. A relationship of love is where everyone in the relationship is saying, what can I give? What can I contribute? How can I equally give myself as much as I possibly can to the other? And accordingly, to strive for the most intimate connection with somebody. It is the opposite of sinna, right? The opposite of ahava, of love, is sinna, is hate, which is related to which word? Sne, which is a thorn, to fend off, to keep the other as far away from oneself. Sinna, hatred, comes from distance. Ahava comes from, I want to give to be able to come as close as I can. For ahava, the existence of the other is a necessity. I need to have the other person close. For sinna and hatred, his absence, even his complete removal, death, is desirable. I need to get as far away from the person as I possibly can. So therefore, again, Rafershi is pointing out the way that Hashem describes what he wants from Avram, take the son, Asher Ahav, so the son that you love, the son that you have given to so selflessly for all of these years, that's the one that I want. And what should you do with him? Lech lecha el eretz ha-Moriah. And go with him to the land of Moriah. Lech lecha, says Rafershi, was such a task, calling him to isolation, attaching himself only to God, did Avraham's life begin. Now we pointed out, as Rafershi is doing here as well, where else did we see this phrase, Lech Lecha?
Oh.
Right? This was the original phrase in which Avram is introduced to us. Avram is, the parsha begins, that God said to Avram, Lech Lecha, isolate yourself from your family, from your homeland, the place of your birth, and go to the land that I will show. So says Rafershi, what's being asked of Avram is, distance yourself from everyone else, isolate yourself from them and cling to me. And now Hashem uses that same phrase in which the original task of isolation, of attaching himself only to God, did Avram's life begin, with the same, but with greatly added intensity does it reach its culmination. And now at the end of Avram, and how do you know this is the end of Avram? This is it. Like after Avram finishes this test, all that he does is sends off Eliezer to marry off his son, and then we move on. Avram's part in the story is done, and now we move on to Yitzchak. So the life which begins, we talk about that concept like A, B, C, C, B, A, that which began with a Lech Lecha, now concludes with a Lech Lecha, in that same sense of an isolation, in which it is man's complete subservience to God, and God alone, and that which he wants, as far as this test goes. Now, where is he going? So he's going to the land of Moriah. So we saw in Rashi and the Ramban what this word comes from. This comes from the land of Hora'ah, to teach, that this is the land from which the teachings will emanate. This is the land from which the Torah will eventually come out of, in the sense of the Har Habayis, the Temple Mount where the Beis HaMikdash will stood. This is where teaching will emanate to the Jewish people. Refersh can't help but notice that that's the word that's used here to describe this mountain. Where are you going? You're going to the Mount Moriah. Says Refersh, if it is true as our sages teach that this name designates the place from which the Torah goes forth, Torah from the land of Hora'ah, Moriah, same word, meaning the teaching of the law, does not really convey the concept of the word Torah, it comes from Hora'ah, fine, then we'll get to his grammar. From where seed is to be strewn, from which mankind is to be spiritually reborn. This is the place where mankind will be reborn, in the sense that we will learn what it is that we need to do in life. It's from this place that the teachings will emanate. And if further, this was the place on which the first offerings, the rejected and accepted ones of Cain and Abel, where did that take place? On Mount Moriah, on the same place where the Beis HaMikdash would eventually stand. Shine out warningly and instructively to the world. Meaning, they warn us, if you bring a sacrifice and offering like Cain, it will be rejected. If you bring it like Abel, it will be accepted. We're going to leave aside what those lessons are for now. That's not our class. But if this is the place where that was taught to the world, and if on this same place Noah brought his offerings on the represented earth, re-presented earth, right? Meaning, when Noah exits the Teva and the earth is recreated again, and this is the place upon which Noah brings his offerings, in anticipatory feelings of the Nichoach, of the ultimate future unified devotion of the whole of mankind, in anticipating that which will be the pleasant aroma of the future devotions of when the Jewish people are unified and come together, and the whole of mankind comes together to the Temple Mount to offer their offerings to God. If all this is true, then Avram was told already by the information of the place that this action was not to have importance for him alone, but that it was to demonstrate right to the most distant future, by the most instructive example, what the fulfillment of a Hineni, here I am, said to God, really means. Pretty poetic, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning he's saying, if God refers to the land as Har HaMoriah, and he's within that language referencing the place from which the teaching will go out, the place from which it already has emanated, the place from which Adam was created, the place in which Adam offered his sacrifices, where Noah did, where Cain and Abel did, where mankind will eventually unify in their service to God, and that's the name that God references the place by. Then, says the first, Avram is being told that this is not going to be just some isolated event, but that it will actually demonstrate to the most distant future and be the most instructive example of what it means when a Jew says, Hineni, here I am. What the law of God, what divine service, temple, offerings mean, how all these do not designate ceremonies, that they're not just rituals. They don't represent rituals that somehow, through some form of a ritual, good things will come upon you, but contain the most earnest seriousness. How saying, Hineni, I am here, saying we would serve God, implies completely giving up all one's own ideas and one's own will, and without any further ado, placing all one's power at the disposal of God's insight and will. That is mankind's mission, to take that which we yearn and desire to be independent, to be our own, and say, and I will subjugate and give my own to you, and I will use all of my own intellectual and being for you, but I give it over to your will and your idea. And that is Hineni, not a ceremonious concept, not a ritual thing. It's embodied in the Jew giving up his powers and or to the disposal of God's insight and will. The name Moriah Ketel Avram, that what was demanded of him was to be a Hora'ah. That you, Avram, are also now going to add yourself to that list of teachings for his people, was to belong to all mankind, and if his God-soaked soul still required support, the consciousness of this could help him to carry out what was demanded of him. You just can't write this poetic side, you know. God. Nerdly saying, why does Hashem call in Har HaMoriah to say, Abraham, in the land that Hora'ah, that teaching will emanate to the Jewish people, you will now also add your name to the Hora'ah, to the teaching, and that if your God-soaked soul need any further strengthening to be able to do so, know that that will help carry out your mission, and you will now stand on that long line of Hora'ahs, of those who teach the descendants of the world and of the Jewish people. Okay, let's do this last part. Yeah.
Question. Did Noah, the ark landed on Mount
Ararat, yeah, which is believed to be closer to Turkey, pretty far away. So I don't know if he means that eventually, it seems like he offered it right when he got out, which would put him pretty far away from the land of Israel. I don't know if he traveled that. I had the thought as I was reading that. I don't know.
Maybe the earth changed.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's a fair question. Mount Ararat is not believed to be. It's not, maybe it is. It was not. It's not believed to be in the land of Israel. Okay. What was asked of Avram? What did the Torah say? The Ha'aleu Shom Le'olah. Raise him up as a offering, which we already saw. Rashi had a lot to say as far as raise him up as an offering, right, which eventually is going to come back at the end of the story. Raise him up. I didn't say to slaughter him, I said raise him up as an offering. So it says Rav Hirsch, the Ha'aleu Shom Le'olah. To the Jewish way of thinking, the concept of an Ola, to be raised up, is taken in two ways. Meaning, to human beings, the material, earthly matter appears as being below or low. We just things which are mundane, which are physical. In our Jewish perspective, that's lowly, that's earthly, that's very this-worldly. And that which is to be separated from earth, to break away from the material, is designated in all languages as raising, as elevating. So you have things which are low, which are physically down here on the ground, and then we have the soaring upwards, which we certainly generally perceive in a spiritual manner of that which is going up. When matter receives life, it rises up from Allah, the life-giving and life-keeping mother animal. And he's referencing something which I'm not familiar with in that word, in terms of the way that it's being used. Something that gives life is considered going up, and a hindered development becomes a chola, or an illness, because I'm not being raised up, but I am being hindered from my development. Now, an ola l'Hashem, a sacrifice, which is a complete sublimation, an ola is a type of a sacrifice which is burnt completely on the altar. So an ola l'Hashem, a complete sublimation, is a complete breaking away from all holding to material, up to God, complete elevation, giving oneself up to God, and that is what the ola offering really is. And there are different types of sacrifices. Some are shared by the person who brings the offering and the priest, some only go to the priest, and some are completely burned. The type of sacrifice that is completely consumed is referred to as an ola, an elevation offering, because it goes up, so to speak, and that it's completely separated from the mundane world in which we live, and it is raised up, so to speak, completely to God. But taken in its actuality, ola is also used for simply going up away from earthly existence, without devoting oneself to any higher calling. Meaning, in our Jewish perspective, he says, to the Jewish way of thinking, ola means to a higher calling. Not only are you being raised up physically, but you're being raised to a higher spiritual calling. That's how we refer to it, an aliyah. When you get to the Torah, when you're called up, it's called an aliyah. When you move to Eretz Yisrael, it's called God. It all connotes this higher spiritual. But on the simplest level, says the verse, it simply means raising up. You don't need to have a higher calling. Here, he's bothered. Because this raising up, when God says to Avram, take your son and raise him up to me, raise him up as an offering, certainly that would seem like it's a higher calling type of being raised up. Not a, you took him from step one to step four. So Hirsch is bothered by the language does not include or imply a higher calling, just a physical raising up. And if anything, this would be a perfect moment to reference it in a terminology that would explain it being raised up to a higher calling, not just a simple going up. Let's read it inside. It says of Hirsch, here, third line, where the indication of this higher calling certainly should not have been missing. It should have implied a higher calling, but nevertheless is missing. What we're going to do is we're going to skip the brackets in order to read the sentence because it's such a long dash. It's hard to keep the thought of the sentence. We're going to skip it and go back to it. Here it should not be missing the higher calling, but it is missing. It does not say, V'ha'aleyu li shom le'ola, raise him up for me as an offering, but simply, V'ha'aleyu shom le'ola, without the word me. It says, raise him up as an offering, and it doesn't say, raise him up to me. Why is the word to me, which implies this higher calling of living, why is that missing here? If anything, this raising up is surely not a simple mundane raising up. This is a rising up in a very spiritual way. So why doesn't God describe it in that way as being raised up for me? He just leaves it generic, raise him up as an offering. Thereby, it was just a removal from earthly existence that was demanded, a purposeless killing. Purposeless insofar as the purpose was not revealed. So that Rav Hirsch points out, in his mind he sees that when God said to Abraham, raise him up as an offering, and did not say, raise him up to me as an offering, he's leaving out the purpose. The purpose which should have been said here, clearly it's to me, I'm not telling you that. I'm telling you, kill him for no reason. Which he says, I mean, not that there's no reason, but that I'm not telling you what the reason is. So that Rav Hirsch sees in the beginning of this story, part of this test was, not that I'm saying that this will somehow elevate him to me, but I want you to do this, and that the purpose of why you're doing this is not being told to you. Had I said, V'ha'aleihu li'wi olo, raise him up to me, then I would have made that clear. But I just say, raise him up, and I purposely use a language that implies just raising anything up without that higher calling. Now, just to fill in the dash, just to read again the sentence with it. Here, again, going back to the third line, where the indication of this higher calling certainly should not have been missing, But nevertheless, it is missing, because it does not say v'ha'aleihu li, it doesn't say raise him up to me, which also, if it had meant an actual human sacrifice and not a symbolic one, and had God actually wanted that sacrifice, would have been merely blasphemous nonsense. Meaning, even if he would have said that, which it should have said, but that would have been total nonsense, as the actual sacrifice of human life is a very diametric opposite of the Torah conception of an offering. But it should have said that, because that's what it would seem like we're doing, is we're creating that higher calling, even though that would have been utter, as he says, blasphemous nonsense. But it doesn't say that. It just says, raise him up as an offering, as if the purpose of this is not being revealed to you as I ask it of you. That he sees in that missing word, li. Don't take him up to me, just take him up as an offering. Okay, let's stop here, and we'll continue with Rav Hirsch. So again, not next week, but after Purim we will continue.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the Donate link. Thank you very much.